Okay. Well, that makes a certain amount of the gun control regulation makes a certain amount of sense, depending on what the regulation is. But okay. Well, aren't there other systems of mass violence happening, emanating from the United States, that aren't reduced to gun control legislation? Of course. And inequality, the unfairness of the system, of course. And I'm not saying people involved in the march don't know that. A lot of them do. That's why we're getting good response with our material at the march. That's not just focused on gun control, but focused on larger problems. For example, demilitarize the police. For example, Medicare for all. Mental and physical health care is a human right. Tax the rich and big business to fully fund our schools. Guns are not school supplies. These are some things that Social Chairman has been putting forward to give a context to widen out the thing, the issue, into the broader spectrum of violence and alienation in the society, which is huge. Also, getting back to the sort of the gray area, I would call it, of a good demand, but a good demand used in a bad way. Background checks can end up being used in a really bad way, although we're for background checks. There needs to be background checks for, especially for, you know, domestic violence and so on, for people that want to own a weapon. But the background checks solely in the hands of the police. Like the police chief in Boston was saying how great Massachusetts is. Well, I actually had experience with the great Massachusetts gun laws, and here's how it worked out, right? Back in the 80s, I got a firearms identification card, FID card, because I thought I was going to inherit a shotgun that I had used growing up in what's called trap shooting and in hunting. And I never did, never got that gun. But in anticipation of getting it, I got an FID card, but I never assumed ownership of it. I was actually moving around too much because I didn't have any money, so I didn't want to be carrying that thing around. So my parents, my father kept a hold of it and ended up selling it later. But into the 2000s, that continued, and I wanted to, you know, again, get it. You have to renew the FID card. And I wanted to get a new one. And all of a sudden, it was a whole different ballgame. I got the first one, no problem. The second one, they had attached all these things to it that basically cost a lot of money. And they were quite intrusive, you know. You had to get, weapons training even if you didn't need it. You had to get, checks. Just to have, you know, this is for like a shotgun or something I'm talking about. For any weapon at all, you had to get checks. Not just background checks, but like psychological checks and all that. And you had to just pay a big fee on top of everything. So it's like you had no then right, really, to just own something for hunting or target shooting or whatever, or to keep it in your house for self-defense or whatever. And so there's a difference between having a right on paper and a right that really exists, obviously. And so people that care about having some basic gun rights, when they see a complete demonization of anyone that would have any interest in owning a gun, or complete the banning of weapons talk, and then they see the police being heavily militarized, and they see that the reality of a place like Massachusetts is that you're basically not going to be able to own a weapon, even if you feel like you need to for whatever that thing is. Like, you could take this example into concealed carry stuff and all that. If you need it for your job or something, you have to jump through incredible hoops for that. It's just fraught with danger to have a ambiguous, generalized, I support all gun control, just like it is wrong and just to say I'm against all gun control. Either position doesn't make any sense, I don't think. That's one of the good things about this March for Our Lives movement is that I think it is being pretty careful overall to not go to the extreme of saying, like, I don't mind extremes, by the way, depending on what they are, but in this sense, going to the extreme of, oh, we want to ban all weapons and criminalize all the people with that have a shotgun at home or something like that. That's not happening, although it's kind of thrown about. And that is why I think it's getting such. I think that is the goal, actually, of the police leaders and of the governmental leaders, Republican or Democrat, to be honest. And they would like to see that right taken away, most of them, and despite some of them using it for votes and so on. And they do want this to be polarized for both Democrats for a sort of blanket gun control, not really being specific for the most part stance, and the Republicans for the most part. Again, there is a place where they join together on this. A stance of using, even if they're for gun control secretly, they or some of them are for it publicly, they will say they're against it. Just use this sort of code word, which is stupid. I'm against all gun control or whatever. So we hope that the movement continues. That April 20th, we're going to be organizing for that to be big for the walkouts on April 20th. But we also hope the movement expands into the context of getting more resources to schools for true school safety, not for more cops, but for counselors, for for security measures and so on, real security measures. And that's going to take a lot more than just voting Democrat. I mean, that won't even help, really, because in a lot of inner cities, as these same students know that are protesting, or not just students, but beyond students as well, know that the austerity measures and so on that are hitting the sort of so-called lack of money. These are in cities and towns and areas of the country that are totally run by the Democratic Party. So if you think you're going to get full funding for schools for the Democrats when they're closing down schools here in Boston, in the Boston area, when they're cutting school services and so on, that's absolutely crazy. It just goes against the reality and voting Democrat is going to just make that worse, as is voting Republican. That's why we need a party for working people and youth, a mass left party, or workers' party, whatever you want to call it. It is a little after 12. We've got to give the legal ID. We are WMFO Medford, or WMFO in Medford. And why don't we do a public service announcement? Another thing we have to do. And here's one. I just opened it up randomly to a paper thing we have for public service announcements. Firearm safety PSA, 4 rules of gun safety. No matter how you feel about current gun laws, everybody should know the most critical rules about handling any firearm. 1, rule 0, actually. All guns are always loaded. That means that goes into rule number 1. Never point a gun at anything you're not willing to destroy. 2, keep your finger off the trigger until your sights are on target and you've made a decision to shoot. 3, be sure of your target and what is beyond. A public safety message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. And by the way, the reality, again, growing up in an environment where there were a lot of guns and gun use, but there were no mass shootings, so figure out why that was. But anyway, you know, I'm saying that rhetorically. We know why it was. There was, we know a lot of the reasons why it was. But people did obey those laws. I mean, you're never supposed to point a gun even in the direction. Like if you're hunting or something, you don't even point a gun in the direction of someone. If someone like casually lets their gun, even an unloaded shotgun, even taking it out of a car, sort of like arc in your direction or through your, you know, space or area where you are, that's considered a horrible, horrible thing. You know, there will be a half an hour of yelling and screaming about that. You know, you just don't do it. Anyway, another one. Numbers to think about. PSA U.S. Healthcare. Actually, I don't like this one too much because it doesn't distinguish between healthcare as a right and healthcare as a cost, which really bothers me. Here's one for all you paranoid people out there, and I understand that. I understand being paranoid to a certain extent. Why not cover your computer camera? If you have a computer with a webcam and you don't use it, why not cover the camera up with a piece of opaque tape? Opaque, by the way, means like tape you can't see through. That's one of those words that when I was younger sounded very interesting, but I didn't really know what they meant for a long time. That's the thing we've talked about on the show before. The hidden secret of a lot of working class people is that if you read a lot, you read these words that no one ever uses around you, so you don't know how to pronounce them, you know? And you get these really bizarre pronouncements going in your head, and then you go to college or whatever, if you're lucky, or wherever, you start trying to use those big words you've read, and you pronounce them completely wrong. And people just laugh. What are you talking about? And they, and anyway, you find out through hard lessons how you really pronounce things like opaque. Anyway, in addition to government pro, I know there's a way to figure out how to pronounce a word. There's pronunciation indicators and dictionaries and so on. I'm just saying, in general, there are these embarrassing moments, these awkward moments where you got used to the way a word sounded in your head because you never heard anyone ever use it in reality. Anyway, in addition to government programs, there's plenty of other malware. There's another one. And viruses that can hijack the computer's camera to spy on you. Ouch. So if you don't use it, consider covering it up. A message in the public interest from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. And we are WMFO 91.5 FM, Tufts Freeform commercial-free community-based radio, also known as Tufts Educational Radio. And you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective here every other week, Sundays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And speaking of that last point I made about the gun control protests, which are by and large quite good, quite brilliant, if you're taking your, if that's being reduced to by someone like Elizabeth Warren or somebody to vote Democrat, that's going to ring hollow with a lot of people from the inner cities and from the cities in general that are controlled by Democratic Party politicians who have just been slashing and cutting all sorts of social welfare, including school budgets, closing schools actually in Boston, two waves of school closings in Boston within the last 10 years, major waves of closures. So if you're going to get increased funding for school safety, and I don't mean more cops, I'm talking about, you know, other safety measures and counseling and mental health help and so on, that where's that money going to come from? Obviously, it has to come from a political party that has as its program taxing the rich and big business. And the Democratic Party does not have that in its program. In fact, there's been a lot of really good stuff written in the alternative media about how, wait a minute, like, okay, you had all the Democrats vote against Trump's tax bill, but they didn't really put up much of a fight around that. And they actually said they agreed with lowering the corporate tax. So we're kind of stuck. I mean, if you're out protesting, and a lot of members of Social Alternative are out protesting, along with, you know, millions of others around the country, the gun violence, and you're also for, as I believe some of the main demands coming out of the protests are, for increased funding for schools to make them safer. And then you have somebody saying up on the podium, like I heard one of the speakers, oh, we vote, we're going to vote. Well, what are you going to vote for? You know, this is the thing. I really hate it. I don't care if it's a high school kid or a 70-year-old Democratic Party machine grinder politician who gets up and says, make sure you vote. Make sure you're registered to vote. Well, who are you going to vote for? They're both going to cut the budgets for the schools. Neither one, neither party is going to say the federal government should pay more than its piddly 8% that it pays now for public schooling. 8%. We live in a country where the federal government only pays 8% to public schooling, where the military budget that the Democrats and Republicans just voted for is trillions of dollars, billions of dollars, just for nothing, really. The United States has more military power already than the next 18 countries combined. Or is it 14? Check that out. You'll find out what I'm talking about. Look it up. This is just, you know, it's really a crazy world we live in here, or a crazy country we live in here, where that can seem to be a solution to somebody. Vote Democrat? But they're the ones, they're just equally culpable on the military spending, all the money going to that. They're cutting school budgets all over the place. They're saying there's no money. They're afraid to tax the rich and big business because they're part of the rich and big business. You know what I mean? Democrats are billionaires? A good number, you know? I mean, anyway, but I wanted that to be a segue into that, this sort of local Democratic Party cut thing, because one thing that, you know, before the big gun control protest and everything, there was a small protest in Worcester, Mass, which where there are a couple of branches of Socialist Alternative active, and we went around to this protest for the buses in Worcester, the Amalgamated Transit Union workers, the bus drivers in Local 22 in Worcester. They were reported on in the corporate media in Worcester earlier in the month, actually way back to February, that they were responding to the announcement of a $1 million budget shortfall. Now, $1 million is chump change in the even in just the Massachusetts budget. And Massachusetts completely run by the Democratic Party. There is a governor in power who is Republican currently, Charles Baker. Corporate media likes to call him Charlie. They like to, you know, produce this sort of fiction that Charles Baker, an old money CEO, used to run the Harvard Vanguard, one of those health monitorizing organizations. You might have heard of them as health maintenance organizations. They are actually health monitorizing organizations, meaning turning healthcare into even more of a commodity than it already was. And that's what Baker made more millions on from doing that. And then he gets elected governor. And as sometime co-host Diego on the show, as we were talking, he always mentions that we met Baker just before he got elected the first time. Me, Diego, and some other members of Social Alternative were out campaigning for $15 minimum wage through 15 now. And in West Roxbury, we had a non-binding referendum going for that. And so we just went up to Baker very politely. Hey, what do you think of the minimum wage? We're for 15. He goes, I think it's fine the way it is. I can't do an imitation of this ruling class monarch. But Charles Baker is against the $15 minimum wage, which if you know anything about the living cost of living around any urban area now in the United States, but especially a place like Boston or New York or San Francisco, 15 isn't even a living wage. 15 an hour is like where you start to be able to survive. If you have less than 15, then you are scrambling hard to survive. So back to the rally, which happened, you know, last Tuesday, actually, in Worcester. This little $1 million shortfall, little in terms of the money available from Charles Baker. Even the Massachusetts Rainy Day Fund could spit out $1 million without even blinking. It would look like there was no loss of rain on that day, or no loss of dryness, or whatever the right metaphor is I'm looking for. Massachusetts has this thing called a rainy day fund with millions and millions of dollars in it. But no, we're going to let the Worcester Regional Transit Authority come up with $1 million budget shortfall because the Democratic Party legislature did not fund them fully in past years, and now this year they are getting hit again. They're going to have this budget deficit. I'm not going to go into the details because it's too much information, maybe, because this is not a new thing or a weird thing. There's all sorts of budgets that come up short, even in a state like Massachusetts giving out corporate welfare handouts to General Electric, and is begging Amazon to come in here now. And God knows what they would give Amazon. Nobody wants Amazon. I guess there's people that want Amazon to come in here, but anyone in their right mind, any working person that's not completely brainwashed, does not want Amazon to touch foot in Boston, because for the reasons that have come up in the corporate media, traffic, all that stuff. Yeah, sure, a lot of that's legit. Especially from a working class point of view, where a lot of people spend a huge amount of time in traffic jams, and there's not enough transportation, not enough subsidized, almost zero subsidy for mass transportation. That stuff's legit. But there's also just like the outrage, the immorality, the resources going to the most powerful, what's becoming the most powerful corporation in the United States, Amazon, to get them to set up a little headquarters or warehouse operation here. They've already got one, by the way, in the area here in Boston, and to give like taxpayers' money, the people's money, to this corporation that has more than enough money to set up wherever they want. I mean, Amazon could just like set up a machine like that blew out dollar bills or something, or 20s from a rooftop in Boston. They could do that for like a week or so, and wouldn't touch their bottom line in any real way. That's how much money. I mean, people, we've mentioned this before, and I'm part of this too. You know, to really understand the mathematics of billions and trillions is quite a leap of understanding from the average way that we're taught to think. You know, to really understand what a billion means, then you start to realize that the money is not only there, the money is like stomping you on your head, and you're just taught that you shouldn't look up, you know. Billions of dollars, trillions of dollars in the pockets of one individual. I've got Bezos is the head of Amazon's like money thing here somewhere. I wasn't going to really focus on that too much, but let me see if I can find it. You know, just do the math. You know, get out the calculator. Oh, yeah, here it is. Jeff Bezos is making an insane $230,000 a minute right now. That's the head of Amazon, Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos. $230,000 a minute. And Amazon paid no U.S. income taxes for 2017. Just think about it. You can't find $1 million for the Worcester Regional Transit Authority out of all that. Charles Baker and company in the Democratic Party. By the way, the Democratic Party and polling data shows a lot of liberals, they like Charles Baker. They're doing okay. Their house is worth a lot of money right now where there's a housing shortage in Massachusetts. Maybe they're renting, you know. The thing about liberals is most true liberals are upper middle class, you know. Most working people are those, you know, the people that say, oh, independent or not really defined. I'm sort of this, sort of that, you know. You really get into the hardcore conservatives, the hardcore liberals. They have a class symbiosis going. They tend to be upper middle class or straight up ruling rich bourgeois class, you know. But that doesn't mean you don't run into workers that say they're liberals. Of course you do. I'm just saying overall, the propensity towards self-identification that way tends to hit people that are quite comfortable in this society, in this really, as inequality just grows and grows and grows. Back to the Worcester situation, you only need $1 million, and instead you have one Democrat talking about privatizing bus routes. You have other Democrats talk, because it's not mostly Democratic Party City Council, of course, in Worcester, Massachusetts, second largest city in New England, by the way. And they're talking about raising fares, which they already did in 2009, which cut into ridership. They're talking about, you know, laying people off and so on. So there's a campaign the union's doing, including rallies and stuff. Socialist Alternative is supporting that. And there was a rally last week. And then we find out this is happening to other regional transit authorities. And it's part of a general, like, unions under attack thing that's happening not only in Worcester but nationally with Janus and so on, even as the labor movement is showing some signs of regrouping and fighting back with the increase of, you know, 262,000 members last year, which isn't that much really, but it's something, 2017. And the West Virginia teacher strike and so on. I mean, there are signs of more organizing happening, and signs of fight back. A little more about the Worcester thing with the bus situation. All you have in Worcester is buses, by the way. You don't have a subway, unfortunately. And what they want to do also with these proposed cuts, all just for $1 million in chump change, is strip away service completely on weekends and reducing 21 service routes to only 12, with stops being visited less often. The people at the rally, and I was at the rally as well, were a lot of bus riders, people from Social Alternative, people from the union, ATU, Local 22, and unfortunately a bunch of Democratic Party politicians, one of whom said, quote, the cuts are only minor, relatively speaking, and MBTA and RWRTA have some problems. So this is like a Democrat that hadn't gotten... I couldn't even figure out where he was, I guess. He was booed by numerous people in the crowd and didn't receive much applause at the end of his speech. I wasn't applauding any of them. They unfortunately had just a list, sort of laundry list of Democratic Party politicians from state and local, who none of them had anything concrete to say. But then, you know, we had they invited up some other speakers, including James Patton from PATIN, James from Worcester Socialist Alternative. And he gave a really good speech. I really liked his speech. Got a lot of applause and raised the energy level a lot for at least a time at the rally. Rally was about 120 people, which isn't that great, but it's not horrible. And they have been doing a good job. I think the union workers are getting out the word on the bus routes, talking to people, talking to the bus riders and so on. And in Worcester, which is a lot of poverty. So you have people riding the bus that know they don't own cars and they can't own cars. It's just too expensive. You have people that with special needs. You have people that it just makes sense to ride the bus to school rather than deal with traffic and drive and so on. And I was sitting there at the rally thinking, well, first of all, I was thinking, where are the other unions? And I have to say, you know, working with some of the other unions in Worcester, I have a pretty good opinion, you know, of them, you know, politically and so on. I mean, they suffer from a lot of the, you know, Democratitis or whatever. Like, you look to the Democratic Party as, the leaders at least, look to the Democratic Party as friends, and they're not. They're actually the enemy a lot of the time, but they're just so desperate to make some sort of, like, this is a good Democrat, that's a bad Democrat. They're so desperate to have that paradigm, even when it doesn't exist. And there's hardly any Republicans to speak of, so it doesn't break down that way either, even though in places where there are Democrats and Republicans on city councils usually have the same policies of austerity and cuts emanating from those city councils as well. So there's this desperate appeal to some sort of consciousness, and they're going to do some lobbying and stuff, and I think it's a waste of time. Protests are great. I think, you know, the labor movement should be doing protests. The left should be doing protests that are aimed at both parties at all times, and let the chips fall where they may. You know, the direct lobbying effort, I think, is a waste of time and sows illusions in the Democrats, or Republicans, as the case may be. Like basically, part of the lobbying will be to Charles Baker, the governor. Complete waste of time. What you have to do is scare Charles Baker. Sorry, I used the word Charlie. You have to just scare him. You have to say, look, there's going to be major disruption here. These workers did go on strike in 2004, and I think they won that strike. The West Virginia teachers disrupted the educational system completely illegally, by the way, in West Virginia, and got a 5% raise plus many other benefit increases for all state workers in West Virginia. You know, the labor movement's never won anything by playing nice. By the rules set by big business, by the way. Labor laws are set and interpreted by the corporations, not by working people, not by unions. So Charles Baker, sitting on his throne, he is not, you know, he's not going to throw down some bones of, you know, $1 million, again, is just a little bone, without an incredible, show of fierce determination to withdraw our labor on a mass scale, and make things ungovernable for the governor. That's what has to happen. Now, if you can't get that on a statewide level like they did in Virginia with the West Virginia teacher strike, you can at least get it maybe in a local level to the point where the Democrats are like also forced to do something. And that's all temporary until we get a new party, until we have system change, etc. But, in the short term, that's what it's going to take. And so we're going to be reporting more on that in the future, and other struggles like it. And I was also thinking at the rally, where are the environmentalists? You know, like, the environmental movement has, unfortunately, a correctly labeled stigma of being mainly upper middle class. Now, there are important exceptions to that in certain communities that are very working class, that people are having to fight environmental problems, like, say, Flint, Michigan, and the poisoning of the water system there. That's got a lot of working class people involved in fighting back against the Democrats, by the way, and Republicans. And so there's definitely, like, grassroots environmental efforts. You could call the anti-pipeline struggle of last year was it South or North Dakota? I'm embarrassed. I don't remember. North Dakota, I'll say. That was lost ultimately, but that's a type of environmental struggle. So I'm sitting here thinking, now, here's a situation where they want to again, because it's already happened before, they want to again cut bus routes. They want to again raise fares. They want to again, move towards privatization and maybe even elimination of the bus service in this major city, a second biggest city in New England. Where are the environmentalists? Why didn't I see the green jobs people out? You know, why didn't I see... they weren't there. They weren't there. It was an extremely working-class crowd. It was the people that rode the buses, a bunch of people from Social Alternative, a bunch of people from the union itself, the bus drivers and so on. There was no environmental activists there. There was nobody there making the connection that, oh, if they destroy the bus service in the second largest city in New England, as they've already reduced it, right, then you're going to have more cars, and actually crappy cars, on the road in Worcester, creating more pollution, you know? And there were some very good people at the rally, by the way, who were like, you know, this was actually, I think, a homeless person talking to me on this. She was like, this should be free. You know, the transit center should be absolutely free. I said, you're absolutely right. Welcome to socialism, you know, sort of, you know, not systemic enough, but it's a start. So, you know, and we totally agreed with her on that and talked about, you know, why it's so the expectations are so limited among people, except for her. She was really thinking ahead. But mass transit should be free. Absolutely. Why isn't anyone raising that anymore? They used to, by the way. It's not an unknown demand. And there are some places where, in limited ways, there is free mass transit, even in the United States, in certain limited areas. This is not a radical thing in some ways, and radical is not bad. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying that, you know, this is something that is out there. It should be out there more. But also, why stop at buses? You know, even a city like Worcester, actually, a city like Worcester would really benefit from light rail, more light rail and so on, or some light rail. It's got none. Sorry, I don't mean more light rail, but benefit from light rail because it's geographically spread out, you know? And if you really want people to go to certain things, jobs, places to shop, places to see entertainment or whatever, and you put in a strategically placed light rail system, even a limited one to start with, whoa, I mean, you just have this huge improvement in the local economy. It'd be incredible. Plus the building of it and the maintaining of it. It's not a cost. It's a service. It's a right. It's something that will revitalize the city. And there's all sorts of, you know, gentrification schemes and revitalization, quote-unquote, schemes in Worcester, like any other city in the United States, ways to make money, and they all fail. They all fail terribly. And one of the reasons is that in Worcester, the car transportation dominates, even with the buses, which don't run enough and aren't subsidized enough and aren't free. You know, car culture, that's not true. Let's forget the word culture because people don't really choose this. It's foisted upon them. It's forced upon them. Car driving dominates. So therefore, you have a city like many other cities in America, most cities in America, where there's no real pedestrian feel to it. There's no real street life feel anywhere. Of course, some cities have that, you know, New York, Boston, you know, places with subways and trains and so on. You get a conglomerate of pedestrians, and you have people that can't drive, and they don't know how to drive even, and they're still able to survive, you know. Until you get that level of public transport, you're not going to be able to you're not going to be able to really have a healthy, vibrant, you know, city. I mean, honestly, you're just going to have a place where people, you know, go to work and then go sleep somewhere and maybe little bit of entertainment or whatever, arts or whatever, not much. So anyway, we'll report more on the situation in Worcester and the fight on that. And hopefully, just to free up $1 million in Massachusetts terms again should be nothing. But I think it's going to be a big fight and emblematic of many other fights that are happening right now. Also happening simultaneously to these fights are attempts to get a $50 minimum wage in Massachusetts. It's got some bad caveats to it, some bad qualifiers, but it's basically a step in the right direction. There's a millionaire tax in the work. TAX in the works that is being held up by the courts. No surprise there, unfortunately. There is a nurses coming from the Massachusetts Nurses Association, a safe staffing ratio, to make sure that in ICU units and others that there's, you know, enough nurses, because the hospitals are being run, have been deregulated to a great extent over the past decades, and they're being run as pure businesses now, so they're thinking always how to cut costs, so-called costs, instead of providing healthcare. And so nurses are being forced to take care of more and more people, and it gets very dangerous for the patients and the nurses as well. By the way, just some quick stuff going back to both the gun control, some of the stuff we talked about gun control, is that, you know, if you're familiar with politics in the United States as a whole, but also in New England per se, you hear a lot about from time to time, and it comes and goes based on the whims of the corporate media, but the rise of the opioid crisis, and I had some statistics on that. I'm not sure I can find them again quickly. Ah, there we go. I did. And so there is money. There is some money being talked about to go into that, whereas, you know, other things are, supposedly there's no money for anything and things are being cut. Charles Baker, this governor here, supposedly, I don't think this has gone through yet, $100 million plan feature, but it unfortunately features involuntary hospitalization for people deemed in danger to themselves or others, and which would be an enormous invasion of citizens' rights if it gets passed. Those suspected of being a, quote, danger, unquote, could be held 72 hours against their will, which could be extended with court approval. So it's sort of like analogous to some of the gun control legislation that would have unintended consequences, like background checks without any appeal process or any transparency, for example, where the police are just collecting data on people and to the purpose of eventually criminalizing them, possibly, by just having a weapon or whatever, even if they got it legitimately and legally. But getting back to the opioid crisis, so this, you know, every once in a while makes a lot of headlines, and there's been this whole thing, which we talked about on the show, how, you know, it used to be, heroin epidemic or the crack epidemic and et cetera, and in very racist terms presented usually by the corporate media, and mass incarceration policies cooked up by made worse by the Clinton administrations and by the Democrats. And this was a big way to get, you know, people like Bloomberg in New York and others, Democrats, elected when they went on this big drug thing, which is happening again with Trump. He's calling for the death penalty for fentanyl, which is a deadly chemical put into heroin sometimes. He's calling for the death penalty for drug dealers and so on. So this issue is coming back in a big way. It's off the headlines now. The corporate media can't really focus on more than one thing very well, or anything well, let's say. But I thought I would get into it a little bit today because of the link it sort of has to gun violence, in the sense of it's a social ill. It's ridiculously out of control, and high death rate from it. And yet the proposed solutions, quote unquote, go nowhere near what's necessary. And it also tells you something about the system itself, I think, if you really think about it. I think gun violence should do that too. I think gun violence is not just about controlling dangerous weapons or eliminating them, some of them. It is also about, why at certain points in history, in certain places, do corresponding levels of gun ownership result in one place mass shootings and violence, in another place no mass shootings or almost no mass shootings, and no school shootings, no violence, almost no murderous violence, or even in comparison to the United States history, why some time frames have more violence of a certain specific type, like gun violence, versus other times. Now we're seeing, of course, in the United States, all sorts of deadly violence from guns and other sources, and from the system itself, in terms of police violence. But let's go into this opioid crisis for a second, because, again, I'm going to make a connection here between the gun violence and opioid crisis, more of a connection. But anyway, I'm going to start with an article from Corey Lester from Socialist Alternative. That's from our website, February 24th, 2018. Opioid crisis rages on as politicians protect Big Pharma. Now, Big Pharma, of course, is, shorthand for pharmaceutical industries. I'm sure everyone knows that. I just thought I'd say that. I don't know. We have some foreign listeners that I like, which I love. That's great. And I want to, like, try to define the terms for them every once in a while and not just assume everyone, you know, lives in the U.S. and or pays attention to corporate media in the U.S., even if they do live in the U.S. Big Pharma, big pharmaceutical companies making huge profits off of things that are killing people. So more than 150 people die every day in America from overdosing from opioid use. I'm quoting from the article now. Fentanyl, heroin, prescription painkillers, and similar drugs contribute towards the leading cause of death for people under the age of 50. Now, let's ask ourselves why there aren't mass protests against this. There are some, but why aren't there mass protests against this? Well, you can think of a lot of reasons, unfortunately. But one of the reasons I'll just say real quickly is that if you live in a country like the United States with no mass workers' party, no mass socialist, communist, labor, left party of any name or whatever, then you're often reduced, or you think you're reduced as an activist, to dealing with single issues. So every single issue comes up, you pour your heart into that, and then you're well-meaning. I'm not criticizing the motivation. I'm just saying it's a dead end, obviously, because these issues are multifaceted. There's multi-issues that affect each other they interpenetrate each other. They are part of the same root problems. And to attack one issue like gun violence and to make that your life's work, so to speak, or at a moment make that all the thing you're focused on. Meanwhile, more people are dying from opioid use. You know, more people are dying from police bullets than bullets from the crazy, you know, crazed mass shooters or racist or crazed mass shooters and so on. Again, I'm not saying that to condemn anyone. I'm just saying that the single issue approach doesn't work. It doesn't even get the reforms you need, you know, for the most part, and doesn't secure the reforms from someone like Trump coming in or whoever, or Bill Clinton, or, you know, I'm not just, you know, it's very provable the Democrats come in and do away. Clinton got rid of welfare as we know it. Remember that? And Obama deported more people so far than Trump has, by the way, the Obama administration. Anyway, more than 150 people die every day in America after overdose from opioid use. That's a horrible statistic. Fentanyl, heroin, prescription painkillers, and similar drugs contribute to as the leading cause of death for people under the age of 50. That's just so horrible. Millions have been poured into programs designed to combat this crisis, yet very little progress has been made. The past three decades have been marked by neoliberal attacks on working class people and the poor. This has meant growing unemployment, stagnant wages, and cuts to crucial social services. The opioid epidemic has been concentrated in areas where the main employer has left in search of cheaper labor, whether that be overseas or in different parts of the country. There's no question that a society riddled with addiction is a society in profound crisis. And this is the point I want to make. I would say, obviously, and people are saying that very visibly now, a society with the amount of gun violence that exists in the United States is a society in profound crisis. Absolutely true. However, how many people, I think there's a decent number, but I want it to be more, obviously we want it to be more, how many people make the connection between that and the what runs society, the economic system, that compels society, compels people to act in certain ways? I'm not talking about compelling people to be mass murderers. I'm talking about compelling a society that doesn't have the resources to deal with social pathology, or, as an article that I'm looking at that I won't have time to go into much, a society, a system, an economic system that generates mass violence and so on. So continuing the opioid addiction, nationwide life expectancy rates have dropped for the second year in a row, marking a trend that doesn't appear to be slowing down. There are not sufficient programs in place to prevent or treat people before and during opioid use. Healthcare and crucially mental health care is not available to everyone as it should be, which only exacerbates the conditions necessary for addiction. There is a link between painkiller opioid use and depression, and for many, using opiates is the only way to temporarily relieve the pain. In order to actually solve the crisis of opioid addiction, we need to address the root causes in society that lead people down a path of addiction. I already mentioned Baker's proposals, which, by the way, leave out a crucial player in this epidemic, the pharmaceutical industry. While Baker seeks, this is the governor of Massachusetts, seeks a 5-year minimum charge for anyone involved in the sale of opioids, the biggest sellers and pushers of opioids, big pharma and the health insurance companies, aren't prevented from pushing doctors to freely subscribe their big profit makers. This is a clear indication of the influence of big pharma has in the pockets of our politicians. They are buying their way out of responsibility. Now I'll just paraphrase a little bit more of the article. It gets into aren't we forgetting these new proposals for whether it's Trump on the death penalty or Baker and locking them up and for long periods of time, locking up drug dealers. Is that forgetting the whole failed war on drugs and the mass incarceration thing that has just gotten into consciousness, even in the consciousness about opioid addiction, which is now called opioid addiction, by the way, and made to sound a little nicer and more of a, not nicer, but more of a thing where we have to help the victim than the previous lock them up thing. Shifting government spending away from our bloated military and toward public education, a jobs program, and affordable housing would be a massive step in addressing the conditions that lead to addiction in the first place. Despair as a result of pressure, of the pressure capitalism puts the working class under, leads people to addiction without the support necessary to stop it. Better and more abundant jobs along with stable housing could cut at the core of this crisis. Safe injection sites would also go a long way to fostering a better environment and preventing alienation of addicts as well as the number of deaths due to overdose. It has become abundantly clear that universal health care must also include a sweeping program of mental health support. A country that makes a point to put the military recruiters in schools has no excuse not to have therapists and social workers in schools as well. Poverty, and that connects to the gun violence issue. Poverty, lack of health care, lack of affordable housing. These conditions create the epidemic of opioid addiction. To make any progress, we need more than expensive Band-Aids. And also, what the opioid addiction crisis shows is that under capitalism, there's basically no hope. People feel there's no hope for a decent future, a decent life, obviously. There's no answers there. And I would argue also that, we're all... We go through the school system, and we're taught the values of capitalism. We're taught individual success, and success defined as making money, success defined as working for some big corporation like Big Pharma, making drugs for profit. Even the ones that help people, in a way, hurt people because there's many people that can't afford them and won't get them. And then the other ones that just make a profit because it's a new drug design to make more money. More than anything else, not that people really need it. That can be success. The capitalist the values of capitalism, competition, of individual wealth mongering, greed, and so on. These things. And I'm not trying to get into a moralistic thing necessarily, but there is a part of that. It just doesn't work for people. There's plenty of people that can see that if they get rich, it's going to be at the expense of others. There's plenty of people that can see they have a duty to taking care of people in their family and their children and so on before they go out and conspicuously consume the way the rich do, even if they could. That it's more important for them to be at home than to be spending 15 hours a day at some financial job making tons of money, even if they could get one. You know what I mean? Rather than being with the people that need them, or the people they want to be with. Anyway, this was leading up also, getting very little time on this, but an article I found very interesting called A Mad World, Capitalism and the Rise of Mental Illness. And this is by an author named Rod Tweedy, T-W-E-D-Y, who wrote a book called The Political Self, Understanding the Social Context for Mental Illness. Wish I had read the book, haven't. But this sort of review or discussion on the book is very good. And this guy actually is an editor and author of other books that talk about mental health and therapy. And wow, a different approach here. Now, this is I think I got this from BBC, but I don't have a citation, which is again, I've something I've complained about. Sometimes when you print out these things now, if they have a printing function, we print out articles, they don't think to put the title of their publication in the part that is printed out. Anyway, I should have written it in, but I think it was BBC, August 9th, 2017. Quote, mental illness is now recognized as one of the biggest causes of individual stress and misery in our societies and cities, comparable to poverty and unemployment. And again, they're using some British stats here because the author, I think, is British. 1 in 4 adults in the UK today have been diagnosed with mental illness. 4 million people take antidepressants every year. And someone named George Monbiot, I know who he is, I'm not saying someone, George Monbiot said, quote, what greater indictment of a system could there be than an epidemic of mental illness? Quoting the article again, the shocking extent of this epidemic is made all the more disturbing by the knowledge that so much of it is preventable. This is due to the significant correlation. I'm going to say this a little slower and hopefully emphasize it. This is due to the significant correlation between social and environmental conditions and the prevalence of mental disorders. So this is basically a Marxist approach to mental health issues. Quote, the evidence is overwhelming. It's not just that there exists social determinants out there, but they are overwhelmingly important, meaning social causes for psychological well-being or disease or illness are the overwhelmingly important determinants of whether or not you will get that, whether or not something like this will happen. A subhead, a sick society, experiences of social isolation, inequality, feelings of alienation and disassociation, even the basic assumptions and ideology of materialism and neoliberalism itself, notice they ignore the C word, unfortunately, are seen today to be significant drivers, reflected in the titles of a number of recent articles and talks on the subject, such as those with the consultant psychotherapist David Morgan's groundbreaking Frontier Psychoanalyst podcasts, which have included discussions on whether, quote, neoliberalism is dangerous for your mental health, unquote, and, quote, is neoliberalism making us sick, unquote. Clinical psychologist and psychotherapist Jay Watts observes in The Guardian that, quote, psychological and social factors are at least as significant and, for many, the main cause of suffering. Poverty, relative inequality, being subject to racism, sexism, displacement, and a competitive culture all increase the likelihood of mental suffering. Governments and pharmaceutical companies are not as interested in these results. Throwing funding at studies looking at genetics and physical biomarkers as opposed to the environmental causes of distress. Similarly, there is little political will to combine increasing mental distress with structural inequalities, though the association is robust, and many professionals think that would be the best way to tackle the current mental health epidemic. Oh, and then they say in this article, I was a little premature, they said, it's time we talk about the C word, capitalism. There are very clearly very powerful entrenched interests and agendas here which consciously or unconsciously act to conceal or try to deny this relationship, which also makes the recent willingness among so many psychoanalysts and therapists to embrace the wider context so exciting and moving. Commentators often talk about society, social context, group thinking, and environmental determinants in connection with mental distress and disorders, but we can, I think, actually be a bit more precise about what aspect of society is mainly driving it, is mainly responsible for it. And in this context, it's probably time we talk about the C word, capitalism. Many of the contemporary forms of illness and individual distress that we treat and engage with certainly seem to be correlated with and amplified by the process and byproducts of capitalism. In fact, you might say that capitalism is, in many respects, a mental illness-generating system. And if we are serious about tackling not only the effects of mental distress and illness, but also their causes and origins, we need to look more closely, more precisely, and more analytically at the nature of the political and economic womb out of which they emerge and how psychology is fundamentally interwoven with every aspect of it. Then, and seriously running out of time here, so I'm going to just have to really skip around. Ubiquitous neurosis, quoting Joel Covell and others in a book called The Political Self. And then this piece gets into Marxism. It was, of course, Marx who was the great an analyst of alienation, showing how capitalist economics generates alienation as part of the very fabric of our structure, showing how, for instance, alienation gets lost or trapped, embodied in products, commodities, from the obvious examples, such as Nikes made in sweatshops and sweatshops embodied in Nikes, to a wider and much more pervasive sense that the whole system of production and creation is somehow alienating. As Pavon Cuellar remarks, this is a name I'm not familiar with, P-A-V-O-N-C-U-E-L-L-A-R, quote, Marx was the first to realize that this alienation actually gets contained and incarnated in things and commodities. These fetishized commodities, he adds, seem to retain and promise to return when consumed, the subjective social part lost by those alienated while producing them. The alienated have lost what they imagine or hope to find in what is fetishized. And then again, capitalism is in many respects a mental illness generating system. The understanding of alienation is really the core issue for Marx, etc. Marx refers to this extraordinary world transformative form of energy, of labor and agency as our active species life, our species being, our physical and spiritual energies. But these immense creative energies and transformative capacities are, he notes, under the present system of capitalism, immediately taken from us and converted into something alien, objective, enslaving, fetishized. And then it gets into inequality, and I don't have time to go into too much more there, but I just saw in all places that you would see, of all sort of sources, you wouldn't expect to see this in. Bloomberg had an article about how inequality is the key to solving, you know, actually, I'm trying to figure. I'm trying to remember if that was directly linked to mental illness, that quote I read. No, here it is. Economic equality is key to solving climate change. It was related to climate change, another intractable problem under capitalism. That's from Bloomberg, of all places. Their reasoning for in that article is a little suspect, but the overall thing is something socialists would definitely argue. Well, we're just about out of time. Check out, if you're here in the Boston area, Northeastern University grad students have successfully organized. They're trying to get recognized by, they're trying to have a vote and get recognized. The majority said they want a union. Administration refused to agree. That they don't have to challenge their right to form a union to the Trump NLRB. They've had four negotiating sessions. Northeastern administration broke off. And so now we want a fair election without the threat of appeal to Trump. Should graduates vote union yes at Northeastern University in Boston? They're going to have a rally Tuesday, April 17th from 12 p.m. to 1:30 p.m. Had some really good stuff on unions helping out undocumented workers. Maybe next time we'll get into that. I just want to end today with a book I just grabbed sort of somewhat randomly off the shelves at a public library. You know, we go into a public library. I hope you do. Hope you read. And they put out recently published books sometimes, newer books to entice the readers. And this one enticed me. It's called The Divide, Global Inequality from Conquest to Free Markets by Jason Hickel, H-I-C-K-E-L. And it was published in here in America, 2018, Britain, 2017, I believe, or 2018 also. Let's see. Maybe also 2018 in Britain. Anyway, so this book goes against what you might have noticed in the corporate media, this sort of narrative that comes out every once in a while recently that, oh, things are actually getting better around the world. There's less inequality, you know. Of course, there's countervailing stuff, even the corporate media, because Oxfam has been coming out with these reports. And the UN itself has come out with some reports recently, which I have here, but I don't have time to get into, about how actually inequality is increasing, even within richer countries, even within the United States. Of course, this isn't big news, but it's just that sometimes you'll actually hear liberals and conservatives argue the opposite, mind-bogglingly. So, quote from this book, again, The Divide, haven't finished it yet, but I'm working on it. Quote, today there are 4.3 billion people, more than 60% of the world's population, who live in debilitating poverty, struggling to survive on less than the equivalent of $5 per day. Half do not have access to enough food, and these numbers have been growing steadily over the past few decades. Meanwhile, the wealth of the very richest is piling up to levels unprecedented in human history. As I write this, it has just been announced that the 8 richest men in the world have as much wealth between them as the poorest half of the world's population combined. So, one other quote very quickly, if I can. And, you know, I'm sort of advocating reading this book. I mean, how bad can it be? I haven't gotten... I shouldn't say that. It might be really bad. You know, I jumped ahead in the index. This is really the test of a good book, I think, on inequality. And there's no mention... socialism does not get a mention in the index. Karl Marx gets a few mentions, one of which I read was okay. And capitalism itself is... capitalism does get some major time. Okay, good. So anyway, I look at these books about inequality. If they don't mention socialism, Marxism, communism, you know, capitalism, some certain key words, I'm like, oh, God, what am I going to read here? This is someone really trying hard to get tenure by not offending the right wing or the liberals that run the show at the universities or whatever. Anyway, let's see. Today, one other quote. Today, there are about 800 million hungry people, even according to the most conservative estimates. More realistic estimates put the figure around 2 billion, nearly a third of all humanity. And it's hard to imagine a greater symbol of failure, and I would say failure of capitalism, he doesn't say that here, than rising hunger, especially given that we already produce more than enough food each year to feed all 7 billion of the world's people, with plenty left over for another 3 billion. And so far... You know, I'm seeing statistics that are quite good, and he's getting into them a little bit, saying, look, you know, a lot of the things you're reading are on global inequality are proportional statistics, not aggregate statistics, and that's for a reason. So we got to go. Didn't know I was so late. Thanks for listening to Social Alternative Radio. If you think the system is working, it really isn't. Check out socialism and get out to the next rally. Okay.
No class, but lots of dough. Got a gold-plated ego. I go to church and say amen. Make America great again. Now what else would you expect from a reality show?